Back in on Canuck Central, it's Dan Riccio and Bick Nizar here in the Kintec studio. You can be a part of the program, 650-650 on the Dunbar Lumber text message inbox. That's where you get in touch with the show. You can ask a question, leave a comment, or as I like to call it, a quament. Bick, are you on board with quaments, or is that...
I'm fairly indifferent. I was pro it when it first started.
Yeah,
and I've slowly regressed into indifferent. I don't know if I'll get to the stage of abject disgust like Sat, but it's whatever.
Would Sat be more upset about Quamet or the way Chelsea performed these last couple of games? That's it's maybe a better question to ask.
Hey,
or maybe Manchester United.
I'm just glad. So. I was just glad. I'm glad you brought up Chelsea, not Man United.
Hey, this is not Premier League Central. Get back to the Canucks. All right, we
Seriously.
Will. 650, 650. How good did Willander look in the juniors game yesterday? Well, it's been more fun watching Sweden in the U.S. than it has been watching Canada. I'll say that much.
It's been great watching Latvia. They just did it again.
The Latvians. You got to love it. Who doesn't love a good underdog story? Even what Kazakhstan did earlier today with the... two goals shorthanded to tie it late against the Slovaks. I'll give the not that I've like deeply invested in the World Juniors, but it has been entertaining this year from what I have seen. And Willander has looked good. You know, it's tough, man. When you're the Canucks, you know, we were talking about trades earlier. You only have Lekkomäki and Willander as your two big assets, your two big prospects in the organization. They feel like. Like you better be getting a really good piece if you're moving on from one of those guys, is my feeling of it.
Oh yeah, no, I don't even want to entertain the idea of Willander.
Yeah,
Lekkomäki, maybe you can talk me into it, but I'm still, you know, quite hopeful. But again, like we're all talking about, what piece do you end up getting? Like you can talk me into anything, but right now, like those two feel like the crown jewels of the organization.
Tough period for the Canucks right now, and the trade speculation won't go away, especially with some of the injuries they are dealing with. Let's bring in our next guest. It is Frank Saravalli. He joins us every Monday here on Canucks Central, and this analyst is brought to you by Angry Otter Liquor. Thanks for this, Frank. How are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you guys? And happy early New Year.
Yeah, happy early New Year to you as well. It's, people here in Vancouver, as you can imagine, are still trying to come down from that 4-1 collapse against the Seattle Kraken. And, you know, it raises bigger questions knowing that Quinn Hughes is week to week. You know, does this front office try to pull the trigger and maybe get some help in here sooner rather than later as they continue to work the phones?
I think they're kind of forced to. And look, this was a need before the injury. And it's not, hey, do you have to step up now to save the season? That's not the message at all. I think this team has proven that for as inconsistent as they've played, I still take a glass half full approach with this group that given some of the issues that they've had injury wise, I mean, they haven't iced for one game this season, the lineup that Jim Rutherford and Patrick Alvin put together in the summer. That said, It's downright scary right now. What you're left with is essentially with Quinn Hughes and Phil Hronek out, you're looking at four replacement level NHL players in your top six, and that can't work. That's not what this team is designed to be. And the need existed before that. The need would exist even with Quinn Hughes in the lineup. That means if at all possible, go out and try and prop up this team in the meantime.
I think what's part of my frustration, Frank, here in the last 48 hours, and you know, we were chatting about in the first segment, it like you just said it there, like four replacement level players in the blue line. And had Saturday gone in a certain way where, you know, for 60 minutes, you look at it and say, man, they were outclassed and they can't do this and they're not going to be able to survive. I think a lot of people would have understood in that scenario. But they play well enough for 55 minutes and it completely falls apart in the final five. And then suddenly, like, that's the thing that registers the urgency to me. It's the manner in which it happened, not that it did happen.
So had they hung on and won,
I think we'd be sitting here like a little bit differently. But my takeaway from Saturday's performance is, like, should it increase the urgency? If the idea was to go make a transaction in late January, middle of January, does what we saw on Saturday push that up even higher?
I mean, I think they had urgency before that. Like, I think Patrick Alvin going into the trade freeze was making calls in the hours leading up to it, because we know how aggressive they've been, but I think they were trying to make stuff happen then. That I don't know that the urgency's gone to another level, but I think it still exists, and it's right at the level that it's probably been at for a number of weeks now, which is this defense corps has some warts. They've asked and put players in positions to bite off more than they can chew. And going back to the conversation that we had earlier, just to start the season, this team isn't as good as it was last season. And I don't know that they adequately filled some of the holes that they had. Not that you can all the time, like, that sometimes the player or piece that you're looking for isn't readily available or doesn't exist. But the pieces that they did add, they're not holding up their end of the bargain. And so when you factor in two critical injuries, basically taking out your top pair, that's a major question mark for sure.
So I guess, you know, one of my wonders here is does the type of player they're trading for change at all? Or, you know, because if maybe they're unable to land a player, as we've talked about, they want to add something that is meaningful, that can really help them get over the top, that adds to this group. Mm-hmm. Or do you pull something quicker that might be a little bit cheaper on the trade market right now, just to be able to get through this period, whether it might be a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks without Quinn Hughes?
Yeah, I think those options exist. And let me give you a great example of someone way further down the food chain that didn't cost a lot, that has helped shape and change this team's season. And I'm talking about Utah Hockey Club with Olli Maatta. They lost John Marino and Sean Durzi, and then in relatively short order, Maverick Lamoureux, three players in their top six that they just... How do you go out and replace two of your top four defensemen for a 4 month, 5 month period of time? Those guys, teams aren't cutting off top four defensemen to trade at this point. So what is the check down option? What does that look like? And it didn't generate any headlines at the time. I think we all kind of yawned. We were like, Olli Maatta, that's the guy. And yet he's gone in for Utah and has been a fantastic fit. He's, I think, in an ideal role and world, he's probably a really good number five. And I talked about this the other day with Drance on the Christmas Eve special. That's the exact type of fit that, you know, when looking at timelines and everything else, when players ultimately return and slot into the roles that they're supposed to be in, can you find someone that assimilates really nicely on your team? And yeah, would adding that top four guy now, would you need him just as much later as you do now in a playoff run? Of course. So that'd be the ideal world, because you were going to go out and do that anyway. But to do that right now, that's, you know, it'd be helpful just from a timing perspective. But is there someone further down the list that you think you could take a flyer on that isn't going to cost you an arm and a leg, that can just help steady things for the meantime and maybe bite off a little bit more to help this team from a minutes perspective.
I'm curious too, Frank, because like it's some of the names that get mentioned about for D-men that are in the market, and if we use the profile of like the Hronik trade that Vancouver did, you know, you know names of like Byram and Keandre Miller, but they come with a certain price point. And as mm-hmm. much as Vancouver can shop in that as much as they want, are they willing to put up the required assets to go get those guys? And if you're just looking at Vancouver's assets right now, like what stands out of, hey, like did they have reason to believe that they can aggressively and competitively shop in those markets?
I think they feel like they can. They also have learned more about some of these guys in their system over the last year or so, since they really were involved in that market, you know, around trade deadline time. And I think that information is valuable. I think, you know, just trying to weigh of what, you know, this team has right now, how close some of those pieces might be to contributors in the relative near term, and also weighing what you know internally versus what you think other teams know in their organization, I think is also a really important part of the puzzle. Like, I think people forget that, you know, and because we're always so focused on teams overvaluing some of their own players, that we miss out on the idea that they may not be as high on a player that another team views with a significant amount of value. And let me give you, you mentioned Byram and Buffalo on a different level. What about the way that the Edmonton Oilers valued Matthew Savoy versus what the Buffalo Sabres viewed in their former number 8 overall pick? So I think beauty in that case, when mm-hmm. you're talking about players that haven't made it to the NHL, is always in the eye of the beholder. And there is sometimes a disparity between what you think the player is and what another team does. And sometimes the idea of selling high, I think, should be factored into the equation.
At the top of the rental market, it feels like Ivan Provorov is there. What kind of haul do you expect Columbus to get for a player like that? And does that kind of set the market for everybody else behind him?
Honestly, I'm not convinced that Provorov is going to be on the move. I think the Blue Jackets are going to need to retain some players moving forward. Mm-hmm. And he's expressed an openness to signing an extension. I don't know that the Blue Jackets are necessarily sold on that path, but his younger brother recently committed to play at Ohio State. And so I think from a pure family perspective, that's something that kind of stands out as, hey, maybe this isn't a guy that you can write in Sharpie that's going to be on my trade targets board all season long up until March 7th. At the end of the day, if the Blue Jackets feel like they're getting significant surplus value, they're going to do it. And then if need be, re-sign the guy in the summer or go after him then. But in the meantime, I don't think it's a done deal that someone like Provorov is going to be end up being on the move.
What about the other teams in the East there? Is it still all eyes on the Rangers waiting for the next shoe to drop?
Yes and no. I mean, they've crumpled. I can't even believe what we've seen from them as they've slipped in the standings and on a night-to-night basis feel like they've totally rolled over. Now, you could look at that and say, well, the Rangers don't tolerate mediocrity. They don't tolerate play like this. Their owner, is Jim Dolan, is largely pretty impatient. But what does that mean for Chris Drury? Does that mean making a move just to do it? Does that mean making a coaching change and letting the players off the hook as they've clearly spiraled? How does this team manage expectations this season? Are they willing to punt on it? Do they feel like they must be a playoff team this year? Is missing, I don't want to say okay, but do you throw, like, I know that they've had cap space and they have some, you know, cap space that continues to accrue. Do you throw good money after bad this season in wedging in a trade for a team that just frankly might not have it? Or do you take a step back and say sometimes, you know, the best course is to lay low for a bit and then trade from a full deck with you know, a whole host of teams that could be in the mix this summer, as opposed to teams that might not be in that posture at this exact period in time.
Well, it's crazy. Like, they've already fallen 7 points out. They're bottom of the Metro Division with how much this spiral has carried on for. And I kind of wonder, like, if it gets to a point where they become sellers and, like, hey, Will Borgen's back on the market after they just got him from Seattle.
Yeah, I mean, I think you'd have to allow for possibilities like that. And look, there's no doubt that some of the vets on their team, even if they've got some interesting contract scenarios, would definitely be of value to teams. That said, I just think they've got so many difficult decisions to make. The first course of action should be charting a path of how do we view the rest of this season. It may look really ugly right now, but to play devil's advocate, they're 6 points back of the Penguins, who are right in, everyone would agree, is right in the race, and they've got 3 games in hand. So it's, you know, it really depends on what the marching orders are from Chris Drury in terms of how they want to play it.
So it's that time of year where I guess JT Miller's name finds its way into the rumor mill again. And we know that this has happened really going back a month from when his leave began. And, you know, the Rangers were a team that reportedly called on JT Miller, and the storyline around Pettersson and Miller has had people wondering, is one of them bound to go eventually? What's your whole read on the situation right now with the Canucks and JT Miller?
I don't view anything as imminent. I think when it comes to, does one of these guys have to go eventually? I mean, again, you have to allow for the possibility of it, but I've mentioned this before. We didn't hear anything about this last year, and yet I'm sure at varying points last season, there were moments of friction. And both of these guys signed 8-year deals, knowing that the other one was likely going to be in the picture. So I'm not saying that there's nothing there. Of course there's something there, but it's been there for years. And the biggest loser in all of this is the Canucks if they have to make a decision and move on from one of these players. I think the best course of action is for everyone to take a deep breath and grow up. And I say that, you know, not pointing at one side or the other in terms of who that's to. And I think the Canucks would be way better off for it. That said, I can tell you from the Miller perspective, everything that I've heard, even going back to during and before the leave of absence, is that Miller and his family are totally committed to Vancouver and want to be part of the Canucks and don't have any interest in going anywhere else. So I don't think anything's changed on that front, but that was the message that I was receiving loud and clear.
It also feels like a difficult area to navigate too, because of like the no movement clause for JT, and one kicks in for Elias Pettersson at some point. So I'm just like, I guess I'm left bewildered some of the times with these conversations, because they can only go to a certain space, and then we're talking about a player waiving the no move clause, which is not unprecedented, but it does feel like massive leaps still to get to a finish line of any sort of deal.
Yeah, I mean, if anything, I'd just be curious, has Pettersson's level of play from a Canucks perspective, like, take all the personality stuff and park that for a second. Does Pettersson's level of play since that contract has been signed give the team any pause? And I'm not, again, not suggesting one or the other in terms of who might stay or who might go. Do the Canucks, in the back of their minds, do they have to ask the question, can he live up to the value of the deal that he signed? And if not, if we have any concern about that, is that something that we need to address or think about before we lose some of our ability to make a deal?
Yeah, which is, thinking back in history, that's essentially what Montreal did with PK Subban, right?
I mean, yeah, almost exactly. Get out in front of it. Don't get to a spot where you wish you were 1 year prior and could have made a different deal before you became hamstrung. I mean, we've seen it go the other way too, where teams just waited too long.
Just quickly on the rest of the market too. I'm curious because like those teams that we always bring up, right? Like the Buffaloes, Detroits, Montreals, and all that sort of stuff. Of you know, these teams have been on that perpetual treadmill of rebuild. And while we're chatting about those prospects and beauties in the eye beholder, are we going to see maybe a trade market this year that maybe values you know current roster players, or is that just the you know, wishful thinking on the idea of those teams that they're going to be able to get, you know, credible NHL players?
It's probably more wishful thinking, although, like, pick a team that's in a difficult position right now. Why haven't the Sabres been able to make a deal? Because they can only really make a deal that includes significant roster pieces coming back. They can't make a deal for futures right now.
Right.
What about the Nashville Predators? They have 3 first-round picks. They don't really need any more, and they want fixes for what's happening in front of their eyes right now. So many teams want that immediacy and help that, unfortunately, most of the teams that they could deal with are teams that are also looking to get better right now and only want to trade futures. So it is... to me, the biggest issue that exists with the NHL's trade market as a whole, we don't see quote-unquote hockey trades, and I hate the term. We don't see those often because that's not how these teams are wired to think. There's too much fear about what they're giving up and what they're losing and not enough focus on what they're getting back to be able to make deals like that in season. It happens so rarely that that's what I was saying about the Rangers and a few other teams. As tough as this situation has been this year, and you'd love to snap your fingers and figure your way out of it, why pull the trigger now? This isn't the time of year to make a deal because you might only be able to deal with 8, 10, 12 teams in the league as opposed to all 31 others if you got to a different juncture in the summer.
Well, it is interesting as you mentioned that, you know, with Nashville already having 3 first rounders and, you know, Montreal, Detroit, Buffalo, they've been rebuilding forever. Like at some point, do they even want the futures? And what does that do to the trade market this year? Because, yeah, it just feels like the rebuilding teams, at what point do they not want that anymore? Even Chicago. I mean, they've already been building up assets for years too.
Oh, I agree. They're not looking for that. Teams are looking for something that they can get their hands on now. Detroit, Buffalo, you know, even I'd expect Ottawa to be pretty aggressive this year. They're right on the precipice of finally being that team that breaks through, and they've got to do everything they can, I think, in order to try and get in, even if you only get one round, to have that experience, to have the excitement in your marketplace. There's so many intangibles that come with that, an era of good feelings heading into the summer for a change. Like, I think they're one of those teams between now and March 7th that has to put the pedal down to make sure that they do whatever they can to get in, that it's all about help right now as opposed to help from 5 years, 7 years from now with a draft pick.
Well, I guess if you're Lou Lamoriello, if you become a seller, then that puts you in a good position given where other teams are, because you know the Islanders could use those futures. The thing is with Lou Lamoriello is, when has he ever really been a seller?
Hasn't happened often, and not only that, but we need some kind of direction here from the Islanders. We need a plan. Yeah. We need... what's the line of succession? Who's calling the shots? What's our MO? And how does this team get out of the malaise that they're in? They're not bad enough to be in the lottery zone, and they're not nearly good enough to be a playoff team, let alone a threat to win. They're stuck in neutral. And with some of the other guys, I know they're making it to UFA. A couple of those guys this year, led by Brock Nelson. But what about the rest of the group? How do they find a path forward here? So many of them are signed for a while. They need some serious overhaul. And you can start to, you don't have to, you know, be an English major to read between the lines of what Patrick Waugh's been throwing out there. There's frustration, I think, abound across the organization as to where this goes from here. And you just have to listen to their fans in their own building chanting Lou must go to understand that this is becoming a situation that's untenable.
Frank, appreciate the time as always. Thanks for all your contributions to the show here this year. And we'll talk again in 2025.
Sounds good. Thank you guys. Have a great week and we'll talk to you in 2025.
Happy New Year. There is Frank Saravalli joining us here on Canuck Central as he does every single Monday. Frank on Sports at 650 brought to you by Angry Otter Liquor. With the holidays around the corner, score big on game day specials at Angry Otter Liquor, including $5 off Coors Light 24 packs. You heard it there from Frank, a couple of really big items and that they he feels the Canucks should be a little bit more urgent to add a defenseman with Quinn Hughes out of the lineup, and still feeling that there's not much to see here in the near term around JT Miller and the continued speculation around the Canucks number nine.
Yeah, I like the bit too about just the current trade market as well. I don't know if it changes much of the conversations here in Vancouver, but if suddenly like real NHLers are of higher value right now because the teams that are in the sellers' positions are looking at this and saying, how many more prospects can we sell to the fan base, right? I'm curious what that conversation just looks like across the league.
Buffalo certainly doesn't need more prospects.
That's what I'm saying, right? Like, you think Buffalo, like, let's just say in some hypothetical, like, they go acquire Jonathan Lekkerimäki, right? Just some totally hypothetical. Like, how pumped are the Sabres fans going to be? Just like, really, again, another prospect?
Oh, great. Another guy who can score 40 goals not in the NHL.
Yeah. And like, I like the player, but like, if I'm putting myself in the Sabres fan's shoes right now, man, like, I'd be dispirited if that management group acquired another prospect.
It would be a tough pill to swallow. A lot of these teams that have been perpetually out of the playoffs, they've been collecting picks and prospects for a lot of years. How much more can they keep going through that cycle? And sure, like, those are always ammo maybe for you to go out and then find a credible NHL player in the summer. Like, we saw Utah do that with Mikhail Sergachev and John Marino. Yeah. But, you know, it's not you can't keep doing that forever, it feels like. And Buffalo has been doing it forever. At some point, you've got to change your strategy and how you acquire talent. It's Dan Riccio, Bick Nizar. It is Canucks Central, and of course, this hour of Canucks Central brought to you by your Lower Mainland Boston Pizza. Every Vancouver hockey game gets $5 pints of Molson Canadian or Coors Light, plus weekly prize giveaways all season long at your local Lower Mainland Boston Pizza. Don Taylor is coming up. His take on the collapse from Saturday night and what's to come next for the Vancouver Canucks. It's coming up. It's Canucks Central on Sportsnet 650. Back on Canucks Central, Dan Riccio, Bick Nizar here in the Kintec studio. 650-650 on the Dunbar Lumber text message inbox. If you want to be a part of the show, you can do so with a question or comment there. Also, at Dan Riccio _ on Twitter, at Bick Nizar on Twitter. I believe we go by the same names on Blue Sky as well. Is that true, Bick?
That is true.
All right.
Although, do you have the underscore?
My name for Blue Sky. Yeah, no underscore on Blue Sky. I was able to get Dan Riccio before the vice president of Apple did, so that's good.
Wait, is that really who it is?
Yes.
That's pretty solid.
The goes by the same name, but he's just ho-hum, the vice president of Apple, Dan Riccio.
I'm having problems with my operating system right now, Reach, so you can help me out next time.
Not sure I'm sure about that. Let's bring in our next guest. It is Don Taylor, who joins us every Monday here on Canucks Central. Happy holidays, Donnie. Did you get a couple of days off or what?
Well, apparently the engineers at your station took a couple of days off. Yeah, happened to all of us. Hey, I absolutely. We're back on the 6th, a week from today. Check treats as well. So we're off till then.
So you didn't get to react to the crazy Canucks collapse from Saturday night. What were you thinking watching that game and as it played out in the final 5 minutes?
Well, I don't think I'm alone in this. I left because I thought it was in the bag. I listened to Batch and the boys for the rest of the game and couldn't believe what I was hearing. I just thought it was over. I don't have to watch anymore, but you know, some errands to do that day. So I, you know, listened on the radio, and as always, fabulous job by everybody at 6:50. I'm trying to figure out. I couldn't believe what I was hearing, but then again, given this season, I'm not totally surprised. And I think we've talked about low points before,
mm-hmm.
and this had to be it, didn't it? I mean, 4-1 and like an epic collapse, like have 3-goal lead with 5 minutes left on home ice, and you know, the only the third team to do that in NHL history. It's just like I couldn't believe it. But the way this season is going, I think at the end of it, I'll look back and go, yeah, that was about right.
You know, the 3 goals in 5 minutes is not, you know, foreign, right? That's happened before. We've seen 3 goals in, you know, 90 seconds before. But, like, it's the game state. It's the context of it all, right? And I just look at that and, like, Donnie, it's been 48 hours, and I know, you know, we are supposed to be, like, trained to be immune to it and move past it. I still have a sour taste in my mouth after it of, like, really? Like, now we're in a spot where fans show up, can't even trust the guys in a 4-1 spot to not close that out?
Yeah. And it's happened twice now with a 4-1 lead, hearkening back to the Calgary game,
yeah.
Game one, and that's just not right. And I know we talked about this before on the show. When it comes to minor hockey, you've got this is how basic I think it is. And look, these guys are in the NHL. They're superior athletes. I get all that. They're living a dream life. But you're up 4-1. Those passes in the middle in your own zone, and I know that's the new NHL, and it happens a lot. I just don't know if you do it in that situation and it burns you a couple of times late. And there's nothing wrong with old school, off the glass, high and hard, get the damn thing out when you've got a lead like that. And it was, I'm sure a lot of people felt the same way. It was hard to watch. I felt for the guys that, you know, the defensemen that are being put to the test with the absences. I get all that, but that just can't happen. And the other thing that went through my mind is you always hear about the defensemen who are slotted, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7,
mm-hmm.
whatever the case may be, they can't play too many minutes. And I, you know, with Aronic and Hughes, that can't be the case. They have to play more minutes than they're used to. I wonder if that came into play there. So not only do you break down physically, maybe you break down mentally as well. It's just a lot of little mistakes. And then you hear Rick Tocchet after the game, again, harkening back to hockey, several levels below that, talking about line changes, and that's still an issue. And it just seems that this team still has a lot to learn, despite the fact Rick's been talking about that for a long, long time. It was hard to stomach for a lot of people.
Yeah, it was a tough watch those final 5 minutes. The snowball kept growing, and they couldn't find a way to stop it. And you know, I think on the coaching staff too. Without Quinn Hughes in the lineup, I wonder, and we saw Eric Branstrom play close to 20 minutes, but I think he only had 2 shifts there in the final 5 minutes,
yeah.
While everybody else was kind of creating the errors. Like, do you just have to lean on the guy who profiles as your best puck mover a little bit more, knowing that you're missing so much out of the lineup with Hughes and Hronek out?
I think, well, looking back, it might not have been a bad idea.
And right.
He's not the biggest
and hindsight's 20/20, but.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's something, you know, something different, obviously, given this mix. Maybe that had to be done, and maybe not enough value placed on puck moving versus size. And, you know, I know every defenseman out there has their issues, but that might not have been a bad idea. Again, we just keep using the phrase, it was really, really difficult to watch. And guys, you can help me out here too. I was listening. Did Rick Tocchet use his timeout at all during the game?
So see, we got text about that on Saturday. I'm misremembering completely, but Seattle called timeout after they
yes.
scored the goal. So
right.
at 4-3, like a timeout was used. But yes, okay. it was not Rick Tocchet that called it.
Yeah. Okay. So now that you say that, I do remember it. I mean, but even at 4-2, I just don't think and I talked about this earlier, how when a team falls down early, 2-0, they just don't have it, and sometimes coaches want to save that timeout, but I don't see what the big deal is using that timeout early to regroup your team and to remind them that they got to get their act together, and maybe at 4-2 you do. I'm not telling Rick Tocchet how to coach. He's an Adams Award winner. But I'm just thinking that I just wonder, sometimes coaches at every level don't use that timeout when it's available. And I realize Seattle used it at 4-3 now. I realize that. But maybe at 4-2, it might not have been a bad idea. Hey, look, it might not have done anything, but I'm sure they're searching for all answers after that game. So maybe that's a thought as well.
Well, as much focus as there was on the players, obviously, it does feel like some spears are getting pointed towards the coaching staff all of a sudden. You know, it's timeouts that get brought up a lot, but I didn't necessarily love, like, deployment. And you know, I look at a player like Dakota Joshua, who hasn't, like, been perfect, and I think we all understand, like, hey, there's a huge level of grace being extended for him to work his way back into the season. But, like, Teddy Blugren been on the ice, and a team just took a timeout. You could have got him out in that spot, and it's Joshua who Schwartz cuts right across, and it's right into the slot. I just didn't get why he needed to be in that spot. And that, to me, is a Rick Tocchet issue, not a Dakota Joshua issue.
Yeah, and, you know, Dakota Joshua kills penalties. So does Teddy Blueger. And Joshua looked like, at moments in that game, where he made a couple of dangles that were really impressive. So maybe they were thinking, hey, he's getting his game back. He's one of our better players today. But Blueger is just so damn reliable.
Yeah.
I think, you know, like going to him wouldn't have been a bad idea. And maybe I don't say that last year when Joshua was completely healthy and on top of his game. Maybe I don't say that, but boy, that guy Blueger is very, very dependable. So again, I'm sure there are moments maybe when Rick Tocchet is kicking himself, and maybe that's one of them. Maybe, you know, your trust in somebody, you know, maybe it shouldn't take precedent over a guy that just does his job. And I'm not saying Dakota Joshua doesn't, but I don't know about so far this year. Blueger's just so reliable. I would have probably, and I think a lot of people agree, would have gone with him.
I guess this could be a stretch, like this next stretch without Hughes. Could be a moment where he earns a few more Hart Trophy votes, depending on how this goes for the Canucks.
Well, I think he got about 500 the other night, so there is that. I mean, does that happen? I mean, but maybe they're up 5-1, 6-1 with him in the lineup. They don't blow that lead because he can skate the puck out so effortlessly. So you look at that and you'd have to think people would go, hey, not just a Norris winner, but not just a Norris candidate, but a Hart candidate as well, as if he wasn't before. But here's the thing, guys. Usually, I'm pretty sure I'm right on this. Usually, Hart Trophy candidates come from teams that make the playoffs, and they got to sharpen up in order for that to happen. I know they're in a playoff spot. I realize that, but it's not all positive in Canuck land right now.
Yeah, it's teetering right now. They're a point up on Calgary for the second wild card spot, and of course, they're in Cowtown tomorrow night to play the Flames. One of the bigger questions Bick and I have talked about today is, you know, should the front office be more urgently looking to add a defenseman, knowing that Quinn Hughes is out week to week, and you could really use the help sooner rather than later, even if prices are still expensive, or maybe you shoot a little bit lower and just get somebody in here now because you need the help so badly?
Well, I noticed, and help me out here, guys, I've been off, slacking off as always. But I noticed Hoglander was in the top six today at practice. Is that a sign that maybe they're finally showcasing him, that maybe somebody's interested, looking back to the 24 goals last year? And, missed opportunity for a goal the other night against Seattle. But maybe that's an indication that he's somebody they look at as if maybe they haven't already, as trade bait. And seeing him in the top six, I thought was pretty interesting at practice today.
Yeah, and he got like his chance again against the Kraken. You know that moment. You know, forget about a goal. How about you get a shot on goal in that spot? And it was tough. And like we were just having a chat with Frank there about, like, as much as teams right now, there's some sellers. It's roster players that might, you know, rise up the market as it stands right now. Like he'd be a guy that just has a circle around his name right now.
Yeah, I would think. Again, you know, you gotta. you have to think somebody looks at what he did last year and the lack of opportunity he's had this year. Maybe somebody would be interested in him given the totals last year. And, you know, Rick and I have this argument all the time on the show that, you know, he feels that Höglander's not being given much of a chance. And Rick knows what he's talking about. Maybe there's an NHL executive who feels the same way when it comes to him. But interesting where he was at practice today. We'll see what happens during the game. But and then I know there's people listening right now who are saying, well, you know, are you think you're going to get a solid defenseman for somebody who's mm-hmm. having a really poor year? You know, probably not. But again, it just takes one person that, if you've done your research as an executive group, that you know likes this player from another organization, some other person in another organization you know likes this player, wanted to draft this player, whatever the case may be, and maybe you get something to tie things over until the top two defensemen get back.
So with his two goals on Saturday night, Brock Besser 13 and 28 now this year. That's just short of being on a 40-goal pace over an 82-game season. Yet again, it doesn't feel like, if they were looking for Brock to prove that what he did last year wasn't a fluke, I feel like we're seeing it happen, play out before our eyes. Like, feels like Brock is earning his big contract that he's hoping to get here at the end of this season.
Yeah, not bad considering, you know, the issue at the during the playoffs last year and the concussion this year. And he's able to, yes, in bunches, but that's the way a lot of players score these days. They get hot. It's nothing, not these days, but going way back to the start of the NHL. Players score in bunches. Nothing wrong with that. And absolutely, it looks like he's a guy that could possibly do that again, as we try to focus on something positive with the Canucks these days. But that would be it. And, you know, then again, if he is on a 40-goal pace, if he, you know, ends up on a – gets 40 goals or ends up at a pace where he would have gotten 40 goals had he stayed healthy the whole year, that's going to cost the Canucks a whole lot of money. So you can't win this season. But it looks like there's nothing wrong with him these days.
You know what else was unlucky about Saturday is it was a rare, like, off moment for Thatcher Demko. And, you know, we were still watching this play out from his return. And he had been playing so well, and it felt like, you know, Rick Tocchet was praising him a lot heading into Saturday's game. And it felt like, all right, like, maybe he's just back to being the bona fide, like, 2-1 starter here. Did Saturday change your thoughts at all about usage here moving forward?
Well, and I'd always wondered about it just because of his injury history. I wouldn't mind seeing more of Seeloff's. I got to think that's a one-off with Seattle's first goal and maybe one other. I got to think it's a one-off. He's just so cool, calm, and big and athletic in the net. I can't see him having a game like that on a regular basis. So I'm sure that they still have a ton of confidence. Plus, more importantly, hell of a mask. With the black flying skates, that is sweet. I don't know who came up with it. It was him, whatever the case may be. Speaks to Vancouver. Oh, that's good. So just based on the mask alone, I'm saying won't have a game like that again this season.
I love the East Van sign on the mask.
Oh, just absolutely, absolutely tremendous.
Donnie, we appreciate the time as always. Thanks for this, and thanks for all your contributions here this year, and we'll talk to you again in 2025.
You know, I enjoy doing these hits every Monday and the crossover with Rick every Wednesday. You guys do a fabulous job. I mean, talk radio, sports talk radio is very much alive in Vancouver. Thanks to you guys. It's really my honor and my pleasure. And Happy New Year to everybody.
Happy New Year to you as well, Donnie. Thanks for this.
You bet. Thanks, guys.
There is the great, the legendary Don Taylor joins us every Monday on Canucks Central, and a lot of quality thoughts there from Donnie as usual. And, you know, he's clearly his confidence level pretty low on the Vancouver Canucks right now, is if to say, like, you still got to make the playoffs here, fellas. And you know, not that the Canucks are in a terrible spot here, Bick, but I can see how a lot of fans and people have their confidence pretty shook right now around this team's playoff, not just like, you know, what they look like, but, you know, that they even are a playoff team this year.
Yeah, and like that's the step too far for me, but like I totally understand if people are there. Like that was a scarring result, man. Like it's 4-1 with minutes to go. Minutes to go. Like you should be able to seal that off. You get the one warning sign and it goes off Juleson's backside and it's like, all right, whatever, like that happens. You get the second one, it's like, okay, look, we had a warning shot, now we got a second one. We get a timeout to reset. Like everyone just focus here for 68 seconds. That's all we gotta do here. And it didn't happen. It didn't happen. Like it's stunning.
You know, one of the moments, like when I was rewatching and that goal, the Jaden Schwartz goal, the 4-2 goal.
The one that goes off Daniel Juleson?
Daniel Sprong, he's just like, there's three Canucks on the blue line, all in position. And Daniel Sprong is able to just like walk through the neutral zone, gain the entry cleanly before it goes around and back behind the net for Jaden Schwartz. I mean, it's just defending so passively. And I feel like that's been a theme for this team going back towards the end of last season and in the playoffs where, you know, when this team is at their best, when they are confident and they are good, they are aggressive and defending aggressively, putting pressure on their opponents, limiting time and space. When they start to play passively, I mean, it's basically a nail in the coffin for this group.
Yeah, that's a great shout on that moment because like the hard work has been done, right? Like you skated back. You are passive if it's 1-on-3, right? Like you created a numbers advantage at the blue line.
Yep.
And you've got to go complete the play in that spot. And the other Schwartz goal where he just swoops into the middle of the ice, oof, uncontested. And, you know, I know like phrases have been recently uttered here of like, oh, you got to play for the crest and all these things. And it's moments like that. I look at, it's like, well, what's going on? Like you did all the hard stuff. You got back. Now you just got to defend the blue line. How is he getting in so cleanly? And it's like, that's why that 4-1 is alarming to me because the right things are being said at a lot of the time, but they're not actually manifesting in how it's meant to be played.
It felt like for the first 55 minutes, the team didn't play like they were missing their top guys. And then somebody like reminded them like, hey, we don't have Hughes and Pettersson to help close this out.
Right. It's like,
and then like everybody's just like in complete panic mode after that, because as I said off the top, just lost complete composure. And, you know, the game just had a lot of red flags. You know, you brought up Demko as well there with Donnie, and not that the game is on Demko and the collapse is on Demko. I don't think there was too much he could have done in those final few goals that were scored, but that Beniers goal was definitely a tough watch. The one, the first goal for the Seattle Kraken, like not one that you see Demko give up often. And if you look at the numbers, it as expected, hasn't exactly been the smoothest returns to the lineup for Demko. And as we heard from Rick Tocchet, feels like we're going to get a split here between the two goalies on the road trip. I do wonder how they manage this going forward because it doesn't feel like Demko at this point has wrestled back the number one job from Kevin Lankinen, and not for me at least.
And I don't think that should have happened anyways, right? Because Lankinen had played such a level. He earns his opportunities here. And then you throw in the illness and all that into it. And I think it did kind of throw the plan a bit into flux here. And so I'm interested to see what this looks like going into the new year. Everyone got a chance to reset. Everyone's back healthy now. If we see more of a natural 50-50 split and let Demko work his way back. Because the goals on Saturday, the Beniers one especially, like I know you guys chat with Kevin Woodley all the time, and you know low danger goals, I imagine, is something that Thatcher Demko thrives in, that he doesn't give those up. And it was so like just jarring in that moment, like whoa, that happened. Did I see something differently? And yeah. he just doesn't do that ever. And like that one to sneak it in the way, and you can see the levels of disgust in his reaction too. He's like, I can't believe I just did that, and he's shaking his head and you know getting it all out of his system. But it's a moment like that, like it's on record now, and so it gives credence to the idea that this should be more of a 50-50 split, even if in moments, like, again, I thought he was awesome in the Colorado game. Like, it felt like, man, he's back way faster and sharper than I thought, but then it crops up against Seattle, which is this rogue glove in that moment. To me, it should be 50-50 until we see, like, peak Demko for, like, 5-7 starts in a row.
This unsigned text to the Dunbar Lumber text message inbox, things I can always count on the Canucks to do: break opponents' losing streaks, brain fart in the final 3 minutes, overhyped, overpaid, and underperforming. That text coming in from an unsigned texter.
I think there's a couple of missing there, like giving up milestone goals.
Yeah, giving up milestone goals is a very Canucky thing to do.
Yeah.
So the one thing that you can take to the bank, at least for now, like, we'll see where Ovechkin's goal chase goes, but he will not score 895 against the Canucks unless it gets, you know, pushed into next season. It's just happening too quickly. The Canucks play the Capitals, I think, January 6th, and then again later on in the month of January. It feels like Ovi's going to need most of the rest of this season to beat the record, but it's pretty remarkable how he's come back and he's scoring again, Bic. Like, two games, two goals for Ovi back in the lineup now at 869 goals for the season. I still remember how bad he looked on the ice in Vancouver 12 months ago, or less than 12 mm-hmm. months ago, and all he's done is score a bazillion goals ever since. I called him out for how bad he looked in that game. It's, I mean, the guy is a freak, but my biggest thing is the reason Ovi is playing as well as he is because of how good the Capitals have been as a team this year, and they are a legitimate contender in the Eastern Conference with the way that they've played for me.
By the way, you shortchanged him one. It's 870.
Oh, of course, yes.
870 now. 25 to go. Do you think he gets there this season? Like, I don't want to put limits on him, but given that he missed games, I don't know, it's still 25 to go.
They've got 45 games remaining this season. If he continues on his current goal pace, he will easily break the record this season. He'll do it in like 30 some odd games if he continues at the rate that he's been scoring so far this year. So it's very much in the realm of possibilities. And, you know, following
he's also
up
never
on
scored at this rate before in his career. It's like a crazy rate reach. Like, his highest goals per game, I think, is 0.7.
Yeah.
Sorry, 0.79, right? He did that one, and he's at 0.85 right now.
It's crazy.
Like, he's like
absolutely,
yeah,
bonkers.
It makes no sense.
But he's sitting at center ice when he's got a two-goal lead, just waiting for the outlet pass and
whatever,
then banking home the empty netter.
Whatever.
You know? Helps when you're on a good team. Gives you more opportunities for those ENs at the end of the day, right?
He's got 870 goals and we're nitpicking some empty netters
here. Hey, I mean, hey, Gretzky scored some wild empty netters, right? Like when he had 50 and 39, the 50th goal was an empty netter too. So you know what? All the greats get the empties.
Poor guy.
Not that I remember these things. Or
multiple lockouts, pandemic to slow down his pace, and we're like, well, he's scoring the empty netters. Like, come on.
So Gretzky scored his final goal in the league in game number 1479 of his career. That was when he had 894. So for Ovi to get to 895 by that number, he would have to score the 25 goals in the next 33 games, which is like an insane pace. But you put it past him right now?
What he's doing right now.
That would be a bit of a slower pace than he's on right now.
I'll say he does it this year. I don't feel great about it. I guess my heart is getting in the way of the math, but I'd like to see him. Like, it feels like there's this swell of people that don't want to see him do it.
For obvious reasons.
I'm getting kind of caught up in it.
You don't want to see him do it.
No, I do. Right? Like, I'm getting caught up in the. I want to tune into every Capitals game now.
Is it going to be like? You remember when LeBron beat the points record?
Yeah.
And then there was the picture, the photo, the famous photo that of just everybody like with their phones in the crowd, like nobody was actually watching the play. What was actually watching the play? They were just making sure that they got it on film because why don't you just bring up the highlight on YouTube at on demand whenever you can?
Gotta have it on 4K on the phone. Quality rather than your Dan Riccio VP aided camera there just to, you know. Let me bring up my camera and get the right vignette on it. And it's like, dude, just trust the 4K quality you're going to see.
Just live in the moment for once. Yeah. But I can imagine like when he's going for $8.95, you're just going to see a bunch of people in the crowd with their phones on and just like waiting for it to happen. It's going to be
just take it
wild
in. Just take it in. You're going to pay huge sums of money for these tickets for this record. Just take it in and embrace the moment.
Viking Stat asking, my new question is, does Ovi break 1,000 before he's finished? don't want to put limits on it, but like, no chance. I don't think Ovi plays beyond this current contract. So
yeah, I was going to say
He would have to score 130 goals by the end of next season. I just don't think that's realistic.
Let's not put it past him. That's a lot of empty nets and power plays between now and then.
Could you imagine? I don't think he does. Cause also like he's a big man. So he doesn't move around all that well anymore either. So I don't know how much longer he can keep this thing going. But it's looking like a record that will break soon. All right. We'll close out the show. Maybe talk about the Seahawks being eliminated from playoff contention amongst other things. In the final segment of Canucks Central, that's coming up next on Sportsnet 650. Back in on Canucks Central, Dan Riccio and Bick Nizar with you. Sats extending his holiday break.
He saw Elias Pettersson was day-to-day, and he's like, oh, I'll be day-to-day, too.
He'll be back tomorrow, and we'll have the show in the lead-up to the Canucks and Calgary Flames. Pardeep with this question. Got great seats for the game tomorrow night. What jersey should I wear, fellas? Hughes black skate or 50th anniversary Pettersson jersey? That's from Pardeep on the Dunbar Lumber text message inbox.
I'm going to spin a wheel here, and I'll give you an answer, Pardeep.
Well, neither of them will be in the lineup, but you can...
Yeah, but represent, right?
You can still represent. Maybe their spirit will lift the play of their teammates.
Precious Wheel has provided an answer, and it is revealed that Quinn Hughes is the correct answer. So your Hughes black skate, Pardeep. That's the jersey you're going.
Hughes black skate. They've worn the black skate quite a bit this year.
A lot, man. I don't want to make a big deal.
It's almost
about
like
this.
more than the blue jersey, is it not?
Yeah, I think so. And it's taken some of the zest and appeal out of it. I
knew this was going to happen.
Yeah.
I said it from the start. It's like, it's great nostalgia. It's great as a fill-in. It's great as a third jersey. But I don't, like, people are going to, you're going to lose your love for it if it starts to come out too much.
You're at the stage now. It's like, we'll just make it the permanent one. And maybe that's where we're trending anyways, right? But, like, you're wearing it way more than the blues.
Yeah,
but it
feels like too long. Like, I don't feel like Calgary had this like long runway of the throwback 80s jersey that they won the cup in 89 in. It felt like they brought it out for a few games and it got well received. And they're like, OK, this is our new jersey now. And Edmonton did the same thing when they brought back the blue and orange setup. Versus, you know, that blue and silver weirdo thing that they had going on for a while. And so it was like a quick run up, like, hey, we're going to bring this back for a little bit. Oh, you guys really love this. Like, let's make it the permanent jersey again. Whereas the Canucks, it's kind of been dragged out for a couple of years now.
It's been a really long tease, basically.
Yeah.
And yeah, you're left in the abyss of like, is this going to be permanent? Is this, are we in the friend stage? What's going on here?
Yeah. Pardeep is saying, the answer is a brown paper bag over my head. Don't know if you need to go that far.
Yeah, not quite there yet. But
you're not a Jets fan, Pardeep.
New York Jets, not Winnipeg Jets.
Yes, Winnipeg Jets, quite a good team so far this year. You can continue texting in 650-650 to the Dunbar Lumber text message inbox. Rafe says, Reach, be careful. Ovi will get to 1,000 versus the Canucks if he's still at it in a couple of years' time. I can't see Ovi playing much more beyond his contract next year. You know, I could see him going back into the Olympics and then seeing out the sunset through next season, but... For him and Crosby, like it's kind of coming to an end, Bick. And I know Crosby had the big milestone over the weekend, passing Lemieux's assist record for the Penguins, which is kind of remarkable. But you know, we are definitely towards the end of the Crosby Ovechkin era and entering the McDavid era. Just the McDavid era, the McDavid McKinnon era. We're full on in the McDavid McKinnon era.
Well, one of those got a win still.
Yeah, that's
actually
true.
You know, that's a good question. If we're moving past the Sid Ovi era of the NHL, what is the next era here? Because I guess it would be the McDavid era, but he's got to consolidate it with the Stanley Cup still.
Yeah, McDavid McKinnon. I mean, look, it was the Crosby Ovi era before Ovi had a cup, right?
That's true. Yeah, that's fair.
He didn't need the cup. They just had a ton of playoff appearances to get against each other. Whereas, like, we've only seen McDavid versus McKinnon, what, once? And it was a landslide, so.
Although, I guess, you're not going to be able to tell the story of the NHL without mentioning Connor McDavid. So, obviously, yeah, okay, I'll concede that it is the McDavid and McKinnon era.
Bick's ready to start the Bedard versus Celebrini era already. It's too early for me. Madison from Maple Ridge has a question, Bick. Why did the Canucks stop doing the after goal woo multiple times when announcing at the arena? I loved when they would do one woo per goal on the board.
I think Madison texted this in last week, and we chatted about this as well, Sat and I. But yeah, I don't know. The woos, I guess, add to the atmosphere at Rogers Arena.
They need the more woos. Whatever can help the team not give up three goal leads in the final 5 minutes. I'm all ears.
More woos, less boos.
Yes, more woos, less boos, and more victories for the home fans, which hasn't happened quite enough this year. So seven times
reach. That's it.
Yeah, only seven wins through basically the first half of the season. Because, you know, they got these, they're going to have what? This one game against Nashville before going out on the road again. And then you'll be past the halfway mark of the season. So through the first half of the season, at most, you'll have eight wins on home ice. It's a wild number.
It's funny, too, because I do look at two things in the you know, standings columns. I do look at road wins and I look at regulation wins. And they've been okay in those, right? Obviously, 10-3-2 on the road, which is a really nice number. And 14 regulation wins, that's fine. And those are the things that, like, tend to give me comfort. And I don't worry about the rest. And then you think, well, so if they're good on the road, surely you're good at home. But 7-7-6, just unreal.
It's pretty crazy that it's been this many for the Canucks this year. And you also look at the standings column, 8 overtime losses, leads the league. And that actually, I mean, I guess it's a benefit. Some of those are blown leads in the third period. Other ones are, you know, comebacks, like the game against St. Louis, where they pulled a rabbit out of the hat and scored a couple of goals late to force that one into overtime and end up losing in OT. But, you know, you got to manage your losses, and being able to have pulled 8 overtime points, even though you didn't get the full ones, still helps in the standings right now, certainly helping for the Vancouver Canucks.
The manage the losses thing, I get it. It's a nice thing. And 8 OTLs.
You can be honest. If you don't love the term, you don't love the term.
No, it's not that. It's like... The fact that they're, you know, 12-0-5 now when going into the final frame with a lead. Like they're dropping a lot of points here, Reach. And it's like it's great that you're, you know, managing your losses, but there's a way to get more. Like there's a way to manage the wins too.
Do you know who leads the league in OTLs when leading after two periods?
Ooh, I feel like this is a trick question.
Yeah, it is your Vancouver Canucks.
Say,
five, the number
who
you just
else
mentioned.
Can have more, yeah.
And they are more by multiple. There's a bunch of teams that have three OTLs when leading after two periods. Canucks have five OTLs when leading after two periods, leading the league in that.
I believe the number
not,
is...
Not a stat you'd love to lead the league in.
No, I believe the number is they're playing 850 hockey when leading after two, which sounds awesome, but that also puts them 24th in the league.
Yeah.
For instance, the Leafs are 18-0-0 when leading after two. Game's over, right? The game's shortened all of a sudden for Toronto. The Devils are 19-0-1. Colorado, I think, is 16-0-0. Florida is undefeated as well, 14-0-0 so far this year. Like you're a good team, and we saw this last year. You're a good team. You lead after two. The game should be over.
Yeah.
But for Vancouver,
what was like, 40 wins before they? It was something crazy last year.
And now it's
when leading after
five.
Two periods,
like they've dropped 5 points this season. Reach,
Dropped 5 points from losing positions. There's a soccer term we're fitting in
there
on the show.
From winning positions, no, it's dropped five from winning positions, right?
And, drop 5 points from winning positions.
And just think of what 5 points right now, or even three, right? Let's just split those in half. You give them three extra points. Edmonton's out of the spot right now. Edmonton's in the wild card spot.
Yeah.
Like, that's how different the context of what those games are.
So the eight OTLs, you can look them as, you manage your losses, but since a lot of them were blown leads in the third period, you can look at it differently, or at least the majority of them were blown leads in the third period. All right, a couple of things wanted to get to here before we close out the show. The Seahawks pick.
Let's do it.
So they win a thriller on Thursday.
Not gonna lie, I fell asleep at one point and I had to rewind. I was like, what? I just missed 20 minutes and I had to rewind.
You actually rewound. Wow.
You gotta watch. Yeah.
You gotta watch.
Yeah, I was filled with so much holiday food and bevies, and I just couldn't last a punt and field goal fest.
6-3, they won last Thursday over the Bears, what was just an atrocious game. But they pulled out the victory, gave themselves a chance, but things did not break their way. Rams beat the Cardinals 13-9, and then with the Falcons' loss last night to the Commanders, the Seahawks were officially eliminated from playoff contention. They will have a winning record this year, but it will be, it won't count for much other than, hey, you chalk it up as a winning record in a year where you end up missing the playoffs again.
Yeah, I came into the year 10-7 was very doable, and 10-7 to me would have been like a wild card spot. Expected certainly a lot from the team like the 49ers, and you know they've had a season from hell basically. So again, still can hit that mark, but now obviously not going to the playoffs in that spot at 10-7. I'm kind of two minds here. Like you shouldn't put yourself in a position given the way the season went. To get passed by the Rams here. But, you know, for me, like coming into this year, the two biggest things were, can we answer the question, like, is Mike Macdonald a good coach? And I think we've answered that question the second half of the season. Like his take care of your side of the ball, and the defense has taken huge strides since basically the bye week. So that's a big question answered. And then the other one is, you know, how believable is the Geno Smith stuff? And is this someone you want to commit to moving forward? And I think both those boxes have been checked. And again, you know, first year for a new coach, like, I think there's different markers that you have to hit rather than like, oh, are you going to the playoffs? And they answered the two big ones for me.
It just, It felt like they threw up on themselves in big moments too often.
Sure, yeah.
And the one loss for me that I can't really get over is the Giants loss early in the season.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you look back at that one, and that's the one game that if they win that one, you know, they're tied with the Rams, and you have it all to play for going into this final weekend, just based on that one game being different. And you know, that's one. It feels even uglier with the way that the Giants season has gone since then. And the other point, too, is the one that's very obvious for everybody to look at. You just quickly look over the Seahawks schedule and you say, oh, okay, yeah, well, they won 9 games. Who did their losses come against? The Lions, the Niners earlier in the season, the Bills, the Rams, Packers, and Vikings. Like, they lost to a lot of the contenders in the NFC. And so they showed themselves as a team that is progressing, but a team that's still a ways away from being that level of NFC contender. Maybe not a ways away, but you're still a few steps away from being that level of an NFC contender in my eyes.
I will say the Vikings loss is also kind of annoying too, because
yeah,
again, we're talking about leads, right? Well, you mm-hmm. Geno did the job of like going to give you a lead with under 5 minutes to go. All you had to do is cap Justin Jefferson.
Yeah.
And he runs right past guys and there's no coverage from 40 yards out. Like, there's a touchdown, right? Like,
the brain fart moments, man. Yeah. Like, even Geno. Like, Geno had a good season in the overall, but mm-hmm. did he not lead the league in red zone interceptions, red zone turnovers?
Yeah. It was struggles and situational moments.
Yeah. So, you know, those are kind of the things I'll look back on for the Seahawks and say, what could have been? But it's been a pretty remarkable NFL season so far. And I'm kind of excited for some of our coworkers, mainly the producer of Canuck Central, usually, although like he's clearly moving on to bigger and better things, Josh Elliott Wolf.
Well, we have Vikings fans in the office. We have Bills fans in the office.
Yeah.
The Dolphins are still alive.
Vikings 14-2. Sam Darnold's an absolute stud.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't, like, Minnesota, that win last night yesterday over the Packers, like, they feel they're as good a team as there is in the NFC right now, right?
Yeah.
It's like it's them and the Lions, and the Eagles defense has been so good through the second half of the season that they look legit to me, obviously at 13-3, but I still have my question marks about Jalen Hurts. Just Minnesota, for as much as I thought they were a fugazi all this year, like, man, I'm starting to feel differently. Helps when you're on a 9-game win streak going into the playoffs, though.
Look, they've earned it. Like, I've had moments of doubt, and I was like, okay, this is the moment it ends. This is the moment it ends. And a close victory here against the Bears back in, I want to say that was, what, week 10, something like that? Then they had a close call against the Cards. And you think, all right, kind of that's when it is. But, like, Sam Darnold, it wasn't just, oh, he's playing well. Like, he played really well against that Packers team. And you know, stepping up in the pocket in the right moment, evading pressure in the right moment, and just seeding the ball everywhere. Like, it looked like a player who had been drafted really high in the NFL.
A loud Titans fan on the Dunbar Lumber text message inbox. Sam Darnold, definitely not a stud. When the lights shine bright, he'll crumble. Detroit crushes next week. That'll be an interesting one to
look like maybe so, right? Week. Like that might happen, but that doesn't take away like what he's done this season. And
yeah.
And he should get a lot of praise for, you know, solidifying their season, because JJ McCarthy goes down. It's like, oh, lost year suddenly for the Vikings, and he's shown up, and he's got 35 touchdowns.
He's getting paid this summer.
He's gonna get a huge deal.
Yeah. Yeah. Wild. He is getting a huge deal somewhere. The Vikings probably going to commit to JJ McCarthy, and Darnold's going to go on somewhere else. But man, he has earned himself a lot of plaudits so far this year. We'll close out this from Brock in Vancouver. When I was watching this weekend and Seattle scored to make it 4-2, I said to my wife, "The Canucks are canucking." She asked me what I meant. I simply said, "They're going to lose this game." Very predictable in the current state of this team. If and when they get through this bad patch, let's hope these hard times to make them stronger as a group. That is Brock from Vancouver. The Canucks are canucking. I love it.
I replied and I asked, did she look over to you and as if you were a genius when it actually happened? And he says, she turned, chuckled, and said, "What's new?"
It's a long history of disappointment being a Canucks fan.
Next, this is the next edition to do so tomorrow. It's 7 o'clock. Tune in.
Tomorrow you are firing up the People Show with Brooke Ward from the 2 to 4.
Yeah, we're fired up, man. Ending the new year in style. Myself, Brooke Ward, Lena's going to be there. Well, sorry, what time do we even start tomorrow? 2 o'clock?
1 to 3.
There we go.
You're on 1 to 3. Yeah.
Good thing I asked.
It's definitely not 2 to 4.
Good thing I asked. And then, you and Sat.
Then Sat and I will take over from 3 to 5 before the Canucks. And Calgary Flames will bring you the pregame starting up at 5 o'clock. Canucks at the Saddle Dome tomorrow night, of course, without Quinn Hughes and Elias Pettersson. For producers Costa and Lena, my co-host Bick, I'm Dan. You've been listening to Canucks Central.